Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Caged In podcast, you bullshit artist.
Hello and welcome to another Caged In conversation. On this episode, I had the absolute pleasure of sitting down with actor Sky Elobar. Many of you may be aware of Sky from the indie breakout, gross-out horror comedy, The Greasy Strangler, directed by Jim Hosking in 2016. If you're here for that, be rest assured that we get plenty of greasy conversation. As well as that, we delve back into how Sky got started in Hollywood and how he used to be in a band and, yeah, all of the kind of moves and shakes that he did to become a hutie cutie disco cutie in the Hollywood scene. We get into all of it. It's a very fun, laughter-filled chat, and I really, really did enjoy talking to Sky, and I very much hope you enjoy this conversation. So today I'm joined by actor Sky Elobar. How are you, Sky?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
Yeah, good. We were just talking off mic about your amazing backdrop you've got there. Could you give us a description of the Zoom backdrop?
It's a tiki bar. And I was messing around and I put it in a last Zoom video I was in, and now I can't get it off. I'm forever in a tiki bar.
That it feels like there could be far worse places to be trapped in for eternity, right?
Yep, absolutely, man.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I mentioned it off mic as well, is obviously, before you got into acting, you were a musician. So, like, was that your passion as like a kid? Were you always into music?
Yeah, pretty much. And I'm, since I was like 6 years, 7 years old, when my dad had a guitar and he had a violin and he had a piano there, it was always a passion. It just hit me like that.
What was the kind of stuff that you were drawn to at that age and like as you grew up?
The Beatles. Mm-hmm. My dad turned me on to the Beatles, and he had a little harmony guitar, little acoustic guitar, and he said, "Come here, I want to show you a song." So he sang "Down in the Valley." Valley so low. And I thought, "Holy crap, is this great? Show me those chords." So I played the chords and learned the song. And then he showed me Malaguena, you know, that little thing, that flamenco thing.
Yeah.
Then he showed me some other stuff, and then the violin and then piano. And it just caught on.
Amazing. And then you eventually, did you study for music, or when did acting?
I wanted to move on from the little harmony guitar. So I asked my dad. I said, "Will you buy me an electric guitar?"
Amazing.
He said, "Only if you take lessons." So I started taking lessons when I was real young. And then I went to like study symphony music on the bass, and then went to Berklee College of Music and New England Conservatory, and then got into jazz, classical music, played in an orchestra, and then went off into rock and roll and got signed by Atlantic Records. That's a real quick synopsis of the whole thing.
So the band you got signed with to Atlantic Records was Seventh House, and I was telling you off mic that I tracked it down. It's quite easy. It's all on Spotify. So like, yeah, I listened to the album.
And it's a variety of stuff. I don't know what you listen to, but the thing we did on Atlantic was totally different than what we did before, because we lost our drummer right before we signed to Atlantic, and we couldn't find another drummer. So the guitar player played drums, and it turned into a totally different record.
So I listened to 412, the album 412.
So that's the Atlantic record. Now, if you listen prior to that, we're more of like a funk rock, you know, a really improvisational funk rock type band. Which is way more interesting in some ways than than what you heard. But the Atlantic thing is good, you know? It's just kind of controlled.
Oh, yeah. You sell it out to the man, as it were, right?
Well, no, we didn't. We went into the studio and we did this great record. And then we, in New York, we went to a studio that I had been working out of, that a friend was an engineer there that I had kind of like a friendship with. And we went to mix it, and the guy came in and started mixing it. Right. And he's like, okay, we'll get it going here. And I'm like, man, this stuff sounded so much different than what we did in the studio. And he's like, okay, we'll get the mix you like. And I learned, and it turned into like, they pulled all the guitars out and all the nasty stuff out and brought in all these loops and shit.
Oh man.
And then I'm like, this does not rock at all. And he's like, well, that's what the label wants. So I realized right there, the editing room is the most important room to be in if you're in a record or a film.
So was it that experience that kind of made you, like, I don't know, feel disenfranchised with music and think, you know what, I want to do acting?
Actually, no, I wasn't disenfranchised. We got dropped from the label, and then we almost got another deal with Geffen, and Atlantic almost brought us back and re-released the record that we did before with new tracks.
Yeah.
But then 9/11 happened. The towers came down, and I was in New York, and it just kind of imploded. Everything in the music business was gone. So then we moved out to LA, and the rest is history.
So, how did you get started in acting? What was like those early years like?
I got 2006. I was playing video games 24 hours a day in my bedroom. I was addicted to a specific video game.
What game was it?
It was Halo.
Oh, yeah.
I was addicted, and we were online playing with people. I was addicted. And my wife came in and said, "No, this has got to stop. You got to start acting." And she took me down to this company that like puts your picture up online and you start submitting yourself. In like 2 weeks, I got a movie.
Amazing.
It got me my SAG card.
What was the movie?
It was called Nothing But the Truth, which again, the editing room, all my stuff got edited out and it got turned into something completely different. And we're on the red carpet at the Kodak Theater in LA. And the new editor director comes up to me and says, "Sky, I really loved your stuff, but it's on the floor in the editing room." So it turned into something totally different. And then I texted and emailed the real director, the guy who's from Denmark. His name's Cone Mortier. He's a really cool dude and a really cool director. He's going to send me the his director's cut one of these days. So
I was gonna say with all the kind of like fan hype for stuff, it will be release the Sky cut. You know, like we got the release the Snyder cut with like Justice League and stuff like that. Maybe one day we'll get to see the cut of that film with you in it. So I noticed one of your early credits on IMDb is doing stunts in The Rocker. So I guess you would have been the stuntman for Rain Wilson, right? What was that experience like?
It was a non-experience because I never did it.
Oh.
And I can't get it off they won't take it off. My friend who coached, his name's Stu Johnson. Yeah. He played with, you know who X is, the group X?
Yeah.
He played with X. He played with John Doe. He played with Matthew Sweet. He played with all types of people. Yeah. He trained Rainn Wilson how to play the drums in that movie. And he put me on as stuntman as a joke.
That's amazing.
And everybody asked me that. And I'm like, I never did it. And I'm trying to get it off my resume. Anyway.
Oh, amazing. So yeah, what were the early early years like acting? What type of stuff were you getting in those days?
Just walking on, saying a line and walking off.
Amazing.
but Nothing But the Truth was a more detailed art film, really experimental art film.
Cool.
But on and off, like little co-star type things. Mm-hmm. And then I did a thing with Jared Hess, which was a much bigger role in Don Verdeen.
I watched that last night.
You did?
Yeah.
I loved it. And it didn't get great reviews, but Sam Rockwell, Danny McBride, Will Forte, all of them are phenomenal.
What was that experience like? Because obviously, like, those guys are like comedy heavyweights, right? Were you kind of intimidated somewhat?
Not at all. I should have been, but they made me feel so comfortable. And they were super cool. But the thing is, I was doing a commercial with Jared Hess for some tennis company. And he came up to me at the fitting and he said, "You want to do a movie?" And I said, "Hell yeah, man." He said, "Okay." And I said, "When do I audition?" And he said, "You don't have to audition." He said, I'll call you and tell you when you're going to be flying up to Utah." So I flew up for a week. And did all this stuff with Will Forte and Sam Rockwell and Danny McBride. And they were Jemaine Clement.
Yeah.
Really super cool. And, you know, Jared's a cool dude. So Jared Hess is like a guy, if anyone's around him, mm-hmm. they're super, super cool. And there's no ego.
Yeah. Because there's a certain scene, I think it's like the introduction of your character. And it was just like, there is the face-off of you and Will Forte against Sam Rockwell and Danny McBride. And all I could think was, that must have been like, there must have been some corpsing or something. Because like, especially, yeah, like, well, the four of you had just got these like comedy chops. And were there hard scenes to film? Was there a lot of corpsing or was it?
No, those were quick scenes. Those were quick scenes and they were fun. And Will Forte, honestly, that guy is just such a great dude and so easy to work with. And he is a comedy genius. He really is, man. He's all those guys are. But Sam Rockwell, man, that role he played, I can't help but cracking up his whole kind of accent he put on.
Yeah.
And his demeanor is so funny, man.
So obviously the biggest collaborators you've had in making movies is Jim Hosking. And you worked with him far back as like, was it like 2010, 2012?
Yeah. I did those short films, but we weren't collaborating. He was saying, "Sky, do this now."
So how did you come to...
Oh, you'll never work again.
How did you come to meet Jim?
Casting, a lady here in LA brought me into some of his short films and his weird experimental projects. and he liked me.
Because those, yeah, those two shorts, again, like, they're really easy to find. I think they're still on Jim's Vimeo. So I watched those, Renegades and Crabs. And there's something, like, especially Renegade, that you can definitely see, like, a through line. It feels like it's in the world of the Greasy Strangler, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it's in the world of Jim Hosking, yeah. Right?
There's something... like great that Daniel Noah told me from Spectrevision was about Jim is like, as much as like you would expect him to be this crazy guy for making like the films he makes, that like he's just a really placid, down to earth guy. And it's like, maybe it is the fact that he's making film. Like if he didn't make The Greasy Strangler, he would be The Greasy Strangler himself.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Jim told me a story that he worked for MTV really on in his career. Did you hear about this?
No.
And in New York, and they sent him out to do films. He'd go to Central Park and watch homeless guys masturbate on the bench and bring that back to MTV. And he's like, here's the film.
That's amazing. Because like looking through like Jim's career, there's like, well, he's got these like great run of like TV ads here in the UK. So like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Before I even knew who Jim Hosking was, it's like when I kind of look back, I go, oh, he did that like iconic advert for this. He did an iconic advert for that. Like. And so, like, even as back as, like, the mid-2000s, kind of doing his weird shit, right?
Really weird. I love it.
So
it's hard to do that stuff. Uh-huh. Like, in especially in advertisements, they don't usually go that weird.
Yeah.
So kudos to Jim.
So would you say that you and Jim, like, share kind of similar, like, comic and like I don't know sensibilities in the way of like things that you enjoy?
I mean, I enjoy all his stuff, the stuff previous to Renegades. If I saw that movie, that film Work, did you watch that?
No, I watched he's got one called like all about like a guy who's hiding his mustache, another little short he's got, which is like hilarious. Like it's just
Work is hilarious, and I love his scripts, man, and his ideas. They're just way out there. Mm-hmm. And when I read The Greasy Strangler, I saw that. Even Renegades and Crabs are right in that world too.
Mm-hmm. So with The Greasy Strangler, how far before that film went into production had you seen the script?
A year before.
Oh, wow.
About a year, yeah.
So were you one of the first people who was brought onto the project in regards to acting?
I don't think so. I think he had been showing it around to a lot of people in the business to like get it made. Mm-hmm. But we, prior to The Greasy Strangler, mm-hmm. We were going to do Crabs, the feature film in Austin, Texas. And he sent me that script. I think I still have it somewhere. It's crazy. And it's, I'm like the warden in a jail, in a prison. And Carl Solomon is one of the inmates, the dude with the gray hair and the beard.
Yeah.
And that's just insanely funny. And we were that close to doing it. He said, we lost our funding, but we'll do something, Sky.
So what were your impressions when you first read that script for The Greasy Strangler?
It just blew my mind. It was nothing I've ever read before, anything like that. The dialogue that they came up with.
Yeah.
All the catchphrases, you could see all these catchphrases mm-hmm. that were brilliant. And it makes sense that you know, there's no improv in the movie because every line in the movie is like, that line's got to be there.
How tight is Jim, like, because it's almost got like this lyrical rhythm to the way that the characters speak in it. Is that kind of, is that inbuilt into the script or is that kind of like?
Yeah, that's built in. That's built in.
And how would that be written just to kind of get like a visualization? Is it like these words, pause, say that word?
Or exactly. Well, no. It's a line, but the way the line, when you read the text of the line, you get the rhythm that this is really odd. Yeah. I mean, you get it right off the bat. This nobody else writes like Jim Hosking.
Mm-hmm. When it came to that film as well, was that like, did Jim give you any like prep work in regards to like, here's like films you should watch or anything like that? Or is it just like, we're gonna make
vision? You're this guy who's seriously overweight, who's never been laid, and you know, you kind of look like a middle-aged lesbian woman, man, like a transgender. Okay. And then I started thinking of this, like he, you know, glasses.
Yeah.
We picked the glasses. We picked the outfits. Yeah, he wanted input, but I mean, obviously the stylist and everybody said, but I'm like, yeah, I love this. I love this, man.
And when it came to like the costumes for one, like when you started to see those costumes, were you like, okay, I'm getting a feel for what this film is like, or you kind of, you knew off the bat what kind of film it was going to be?
The costumes really brought it together in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, when we started doing a whole 2 hours of wearing underwear only in the fitting, and then these pink outfits.
Well, it looks,
you know, then.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Go ahead. I think it's on the like director's the commentary you guys did. Like, I think it's one of you remarked that it's like one of the most there's like some of the most comfortable outfits as well. Like you get these like amazing like two pieces that kind of like. Like roll necks and like the long trousers, like the flowing trousers and stuff like that. It looks like it's pretty comfortable to be in that stuff, right?
It's comfortable, but you know, when you look at yourself in the mirror, you're really getting definitely a vision of what this thing is. I mean, I never wore stuff like that before, ever in my life.
What was the discussion that did like, when it came to the prosthetic for Braden's tiny penis? Was it like, when were you like aware?
Jim, we were over in a place in Burbank at some place that made them. And he says, Sky, you're going to have a tiny penis. And Michael, you're going to have a huge penis. It looks like a rat's head. And that was it. I'm like, oh, okay, I get it.
What was the vibe like on set for that film? Was it like, I don't know, because
since it was a low budget, it was like, we had to like, you know, a lot of dialogue, a lot of like scenes that we couldn't like do over and over and over and over and over and over. We did this stuff quickly.
And what was what was it like working with Michael? Like, he seems like I haven't seen him in anything else, but like he's magnetic.
And you never will. I'm kidding. he's definitely an interesting actor to play off of. He gives you a lot to as a father, to take in and
Were there scenes in the movie that were like particularly hard to get through? Like, was it that pressure of obviously like we've got a low budget, we've got time constraints, but were there like, how are you at corpsing? Are you okay? Or are you just kind of
at what?
Breaking character and like laughing in a scene, or are you kind of
No, we didn't break any character. No, there wasn't any.
No, for that.
It was boom, we're doing this scene. And it was, these scenes are very dialogue intensive.
Yeah.
So you're not really thinking about breaking out of anything. You're like in this thing.
Yeah.
It's intense.
Yeah, because it's almost like Nadsat or something, like the language. Do you know what I mean? It like reminds me like as bizarre as the Greasy Strangler is, like it's like something like A Clockwork Orange, where like this world has got its own like speech and rhythms and stuff like that.
Absolutely. So we were intensely, you know, immersed in that world.
One of the things I wanted to ask you was, what were your impressions like once the film had wrapped and you first saw it? Like, was it the film you had read the script of?
It was, let me put my earpiece in, it fell out. It was way, way, way weirder than I thought it was going to be. You know, it was pretty stark in weirdness. And then seeing it for the first time at Sundance.
Yeah.
With like sold out theaters. That had an effect.
Yeah.
You know, people standing room only, people walking out because they were grossed out.
Amazing.
It was pretty intense. More intense than the filming.
Yeah, what was that experience like at Sundance? Because obviously
surreal.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you're kind of like the way you've explained making of the film, it kind of felt like bam, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. And then it's like, oh, now we're at one of the most prestigious festivals in the world.
And you know what I thought when before it went to Sundance or it got accepted to Sundance? I thought, this film is going to be a great film. It's going to be interesting and like nothing like anything that's ever been done before. And that's enough for me. It's not going to do anything. I thought, people are going to like walk away from this because it's so weird. What? And and then we get there and we're at the opening night where you go into that big party.
Yeah.
And that's all that people are talking about in the line. And I'm thinking, oh shit.
Well, it seemed like a lot of people really wanted for the movie to get made, because I've seen like when you first watch it, like there's a few different like studio cards coming up, whether it's Rook Films, like Ben Wheatley's company, or Spectrevision, or is it like Timpson, like Ant Timpson's company, and like.
Well, here's the thing, dude. Yeah, there's a common denominator in all those companies. They're a bunch of weird, crazy motherfuckers.
Yeah. that's what I like about it. It kind of, yeah. It very much feels like the weirdos have all come together to be like, are we, like, they've read the script and have all gone, we want this weird, like, nobody else might enjoy this.
We're gonna enjoy it. Yeah. That's exactly what it was, including Daniel Noah. Yeah. More than so with Daniel Noah.
Well, I think I remember him telling me that Elijah Wood, like I think Ant Timpson had given him the, or Tim League had given him the script, and he kind of broke Spectrevision protocol by like, instead of running it by anyone, just went, we've got to help fund this movie, because it's like nothing I've ever read before. Like, how does it feel to like have that backing from like Elijah Wood and like a Ben Wheatley, like knowing that they're the people kind of helping this ship go forward?
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. I mean, they made it happen. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Elijah and Daniel. Thank you, Ant.
So when the film's like,
thanks, Tim League.
Yeah. So when the film came out, obviously it kind of very quickly started to gain this like, I don't like almost like cult-like status overnight, and then almost like a notoriety of being like, it's like the gross out movie of the year. You've got to see it. What was it like being in the middle of that kind of storm and seeing the reactions as they started to come out?
I thought I was great. It's like being the underdog in these big film festivals and you walk in and you're like, oh God, this guy. Oh God, this film. You know what I'm saying? The underdog, man.
Yeah, definitely.
I did this movie with Alex Pettifer. You know who Alex is?
Yeah, is that Backroads, right?
Yeah, I did Backroads, and all my scenes were cut. they edited the film perfectly. Yeah. I could see how a lot of that stuff would throw off the momentum of the film. That's what I thought. But anyway, we were sitting at lunch one day, and I'm across from Alex, the super cool dude, man. And he's like, I saw The Greasy Strangler. And I'm like, really, man? He said, you are a sick fuck.
That's amazing. Yeah, man. What are, like, in regards to, like, kind of interactions you've had involving the film, what is the thing you kind of hear the most from people? What do they kind of quote at you in regards to The Greasy Strangler?
Well, the people that like it, you know, are all about the quotes.
Yeah.
You know, they come at you with, you know, all the catchphrases. Yeah. The people that don't like it are like, how could you be a part of this thing?
Crossing the street when they see you.
Yeah. You know, how could you wear that little penis?
Have you ever had, like, any interactions where people, like, I don't know, try and show off to you by, like, eating greasy food or anything like that? Or, like,
online all the time. People are sending me stuff where they're putting big sticks of butter in their coffee or drinking grease. On Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, they're sending me these. Pretty much, there's a guy named Oliver over in England who runs the Greasy Strangler UK fan club. And he grossed Jim out. I won't tell you what he did. It had to do with the poo that flew around the room. You know, that turned out to be Big Ronnie's poo, not mine.
Yeah, the finger pointing at you, right?
Yeah. These guys are doing this all the time, trying to gross me out.
Amazing. What is it like to kind of, because obviously the film, what, it's 5 years old now, and it's kind of, it's developed like a lot.
In October, it's 5 years since the screening at Nighthawk in Brooklyn, the actual premiere.
Yeah. So like and it's gained this, as I said, it's like this cult film, like. That must feel, I don't know, how does that feel for you? Are you kind of a bit like, are you proud? You sound very proud of the film. Are you like,
I am very.
Amazing.
You know, I feel like it was such luck meeting Jim and doing The Greasy Strangler. I mean, think about the odds in the universe of acting.
So do you think that the film had like a kind of like knock-on effect to stuff that you've done since, like obviously outside of working with Jim?
Has had what kind of an
knock-on
effect?
Knock-on effects, like kind of like benefited, like, do you know what I mean? Have you kind of found that you're in more
space? Well, I mean, yeah, a lot of things came from The Greasy Strangler, a lot. You know, different roles where people say, you know, I think you could, you're perfect for this role. We saw you in The Greasy Strangler and you'd play this guy really well and that kind of stuff, and not auditioning for things, which is another amazing benefit.
Yeah, I didn't quite finish the film, but I watched some of Under the Silver Lake and like saw some of your moments, and it felt like, oh, that is a perfect Sky Elabar role. Like, was that one of those instances where you didn't have to audition? Or
the actual role that I auditioned for was was the guy, the songwriter, the old guy that he bashed his head in with a guitar. I was going to play that guy and they were going to make me look 100 years old. And I was really hoping I could do that. But they gave it to another guy because they said they couldn't make me look 100 years old. This guy looks better.
This guy looks old.
So we want you to play this thing.
What was that experience like? Because obviously that film's like kind of...
It was great. It was a one-day thing. Walk on, do the thing all day. It was an all-day thing. Hang out with Andrew Garfield, who's a super dude. Great guy. And that was it. And then I went to the premiere in Hollywood.
Amazing. And one of the projects that absolutely blew me away that you're in is Joe Talbot's American Paradise, like the short film you're in.
Where did you find this? Where did you see this?
I saw it online. I'm not gonna divulge just because I couldn't watch it by any legal means, but like I was desperate to see it because I've kind of like.
Wait a second! I've been trying to watch it. I've been texting him, Joe. He gave me a password 2 years ago. Now the password doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I think it's on a Vimeo, but yeah, you need a password for it. But like, I was absolutely floored by it.
You nicked the password.
Hey, I'm not a bullshit artist. That's what I'm calling right now.
So listen, man, listen. That thing is going to be made into an HBO series. Wow. They're talking to him and the producer about making that American Paradise into an HBO 10 episode series featuring none other than Sky Elobar.
For people who haven't seen it, like what is the kind of premise of American Paradise?
It's basically the result, the post-apocalyptic result of Trump's America.
It's based on a true story, right?
About a guy who just loses his fucking shit in desperation, puts on a black man's mask and goes out and robs a bank to try to change his life, take the money and change his life. And disappear into this idyllic fantasy world.
I don't know what it is. It's one of those things. It's like, as a short, like it left me wanting more, and like instantly I went out and ordered like a copy of Joe's film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, because I was like, if this is the world he's creating, like I want to be. I want to be in it. It's like it's fascinating. What was that shoot like? And kind of because obviously that
which shoot, the American Paradise? That was intense because we rehearsed. Four or five days in San Francisco before we did that short film. I rehearsed with him and got the mask and rehearsed with the mask on and did all this stuff. Then we did the shoot, which was like 5 days. It was about 9 or 10 days of work on that short film. And it was the bank scene was intense.
Yeah. It's great. I absolutely, as I said, I absolutely loved it. And
we won some awards.
Yeah,
they
won awards at Sundance, right?
And the IMAX award, $5,000 award. Yeah, and I've been trying to watch it ever since and turn people onto it.
Yeah, I'm really surprised. Like, it kind of feels like it should be, because I'll wait till the Blu-ray turns up, but it feels like the type of thing that would be perfect for, because obviously it's like the story of the short film is like bookended with the guys fishing. And one of them is the lead in The Last Black Man in San Francisco, right? And it almost, he's even like from the poster, he's dressed exactly the same. It feels like you're very much in these shared universe, like films.
Well, I'm just glad I was, man. I loved American Paradise. So more work to come with Joe.
Perfect, perfect. Well, I guess one of the things we really should talk about is the thing that kind of got us to like start chatting and like spurred me on to invite you on the podcast was I had no idea about, because obviously like stuff like this isn't credited on IMDb, but you've been in 4 commercials directed by Roman Coppola. Like what, how did they come about? Like what came first? Was it the Nokia or the Toyota adverts?
The Nokia came first. I auditioned for that and then got the second one, the third one, and the fourth one just because he liked me. And this was obviously pre-COVID, where his auditioning techniques in a callback type situation are different than anybody else. He lined everybody up like a firing squad. And he came up to you and like interacted with you.
Amazing.
And did some things and got a feel for you, got a real feel for you. And he's an intuitive dude and a very well-dressed gentleman.
Yeah, I guess he gets that from his dad, right? This kind of like this.
Yeah, he's really buttoned up, but really, really relaxed, but buttoned up and super creative. And his direction is super simple. Never confusing at all. So I had a lot of fun doing those, the Nokia, the 2 Nokias, and then the, they were, Honda commercials.
Yeah. They're all like, again, like if people can find them online, they are like super fun adverts and they very much feel, I don't know, they feel like they're made by a director. Do you know what I mean? Not like a,
yeah,
they're not just like a kind of, I don't know, someone starting out or something like that.
I don't think they're telling him what to do. He seems like he's running the freaking show, man. Whereas on other things, the directors are going like this. Okay, Sky. Oh, wait, hold on a second. Okay. Forget about that, Sky. Roman Coppola's like directing the whole freaking thing. And you get no feeling that somebody back there is telling him what to do. I like that.
It's great to obviously like, that feeling that you get, like obviously you said he cast you in the first one and then was like, here's a second, here's a third, here's a fourth. How does that feel as an actor? Like to obviously, and what roles did you kind of get off the back of the Greasy Strangler that people were like, we just want you for this particular part?
A bunch of comedy stuff with like web series comedy stuff that's out there on my IMDb. I did an audition for, and I just did a thing with this director, Alan Cordell, called The Lizard Laughed. It's not up on my IMDb yet. We filmed it in Santa Fe, and it's getting made into a feature film, and it's based off of the graphic novel by Noah Van Sciver. Have you ever heard Noah Van Sciver? He's great, but this is a really great story and it's going to turn into a feature film. And Ben Evans, you can see on the IMDb, is a book written by Josh Malerman, the Bird Box guy. We made Ben, I got that. The guy sent me the script and says, "You're Ben Evans," and so that's getting funded right as we speak. We're going to make a feature film out of that, and Sky Elevar is the lead from the Greasy Strangler. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Tim. Tim League. Thanks, Noah.
back to Jim, and obviously you did An Evening with Beverly Loughlin. How was that different to the Greasy Strangler because obviously the budget was bigger. Obviously, like now you've got Jermaine Clement and like Aubrey Plaza, or was it kind of the same, like the same vibe? Like Jim was like,
well, for it, it was different for me because I went up there to Eureka for 3 weeks and worked maybe 11, 12, 13 days out of the 3 weeks. So I had some time off in between. And the scene, it's not like as work intensive as the Greasy Strangler for me. For those guys, it's a lot of work and a lot of stuff. But it was a lot of fun, man. It was a lot of fun working with Emil Hirsch and
I don't think either of us are going to get it.
That was fun.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, and this is like a just a personal, was the dance your idea that you do in An Evening with Beverly Loughlin?
That was a collaboration. Yeah. Jim came in and said, you're gonna do this thing. You're gonna do a body popping thing. And I said, okay, so I did this body popping thing, whatever I came up with. And he's like, simplify it, Sky. And then I just did something else. And I said, how about this? Where I'm like, you know, going down. He said, yeah, go down, down, down. And we got it. And he said, that's the one.
So with
so it was a collaboration with Jim and David Wyke.
So with like An Evening with Beverly Loughlin, is there a fact like because you're not in every like frame of like basically every frame of the film like you were with the Greasy Strangler, do you kind of get to enjoy it in a different way than you would like watching the Greasy Strangler?
I enjoy everything Jim does. I really enjoyed it. Each time I watch Beverly Loughlin, I think, man, I love this even more. It's so weird. Yeah, and you start getting the rhythm of the thing more. And I think Jermaine is genius in this thing.
In regards to like Beverly Loughlin, is it this like melding of the two worlds? It's like you get like the guys who were in the Greasy Strangler, but then obviously like the budget has gone up. So you have like the Aubrey Plaza and like, obviously I guess more people were like wanting to, I don't know, like not necessarily like wanting to work, you know what I mean? Like in that thing of like Jim's all of a sudden, like he's made this breakout film. And then like, what, yeah. Was it like, did it feel different Jim, making that film?
I think Jim is, Jim's world, we're a part of his world. And I think we come up in his world when, you know, when it suits, right? Okay, bring Sky in, bring Sam in. And bring Carl in. We've locked onto his world. So, you know, if he says, hey, you're going to play Carl. I wanted to play Rodney von Donkensteiger because I actually auditioned for that role like 2 years before the film, before Greasy Strangler. I auditioned. I said, I really want to be, and this is before anyone was ever cast in this thing. I said, I want to be Rodney von Donkensteiger. He said, okay, Sky. And then somebody came in with money and said, no, Sky's not being Rodney von Donkensteiger. Sorry, Sky. You may be Rodney von Donkensteiger in your mind, but it's, you know, this guy in England, this famous dude.
I actually
love, man.
Yeah, Matt Berry. He's like kind of,
he's genius.
Well, he's got this thing as well, and I think he very much fits into the world of like Jim's films because he's known in the UK for just having like this odd cadence to his voice of just like all of a sudden it'll go up like, or like it's kind of like the voice like does its own thing and stuff like that. And like, yeah, it's been in like some of the greatest like UK sitcoms and stuff like that. There's, I think it's just hit American Amazon Prime. There's a, if you've never seen it, there's a show called Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which is like,
I gotta like, see it.
It's fantastic. So it's basically you will, if yeah, it's kind of.
So do you like the Toast of London?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just wondering if that was made for us.
That's
you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. That's come. I think they're bringing that back and it's going to be set in Hollywood.
I love it. Oh, I love it, man.
Yeah. So if they're going to be filming Toast of Tinseltown, like,
really?
Yeah. They're going to be like Toast trying to break America. So you need to hit up your car. You need to hit up your manager and your agent, Sky.
If the powers that be, like the world of Sky Elevar, they'll call me. But I've got a whole rider in my contract that says my dog Coco, you saw my little puppy up here. Yeah. He's got to be in every scene.
real diva moves.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
Yeah, obviously you've continued working. Well, you continued working with Jim as well, and you've popped up in Tropical Cocktails, which, like, unfortunately, has never been released here in the UK. Like,
for some unfortunately, reason. It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's crazy. I get to piss my pants all day, and Sam, you know the Indian tourist.
Yeah.
He's in a cat outfit or something with it where the butt is cut out and all he does is crawl around. Oh, is it? It's ridiculous. I won't give it away, but there's one scene that's just gonna you're gonna piss your pants when you watch this scene.
Amazing. I'll be trying to track that down. So yeah, as we're getting close to an hour, the hour mark.
We are?
Yeah. Wow. So I was
a lot of fun, man.
What type of what projects have you got coming up in the future that you can, like, obviously you've mentioned a few. Is there
Ben Evans thing and the Lizard Laugh thing, they're gonna happen, and you know, whatever else comes, you know, hopefully this American Paradise, they green light that and I'm on HBO.
I will, like, as I said, like, yeah, I can't testify enough how much I enjoyed that short. So to get, whether it's like a 8-10 part
series. Thanks, man. Yeah. Thanks, dude.
No worries.
Really appreciate it.
Obviously, I started off this podcast looking at the films of Nicolas Cage, and I ask all my guests that come on, which is their favorite Nicolas Cage film? Do you have a particular favorite Nicolas Cage film, Sky?
Of course I do. Mandy.
Yeah.
I was going to say,
are you saying that because, like, the Spectre
Vision? No. I saw it at Sundance, and Daniel Noah got me in, and there was a line 5 miles long, and he got me in, and it was excellent. It was crazy.
Amazing.
It had an impact on me.
What is it about that film that you particularly enjoy?
I think he's absolutely out of control.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Do you find yourself ever, like, is there particular actors or directors that you, like, want to work with as an actor, or are you kind of happy to see what comes and just kind of, like, roll with the punches?
I'd like to be able to work with, you know, Ridley Scott, mm-hmm. Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese,
yeah.
You know, but usually what comes my way is new guys that have brilliant ideas, that have a future in front of them. And I look at it and, you know, want to hop on their carriage, man, or hop on their bus, man, for a ride.
Amazing. Hop on the train for a bit and then and then hopefully get taken along for the ride. Amazing.
Absolutely.
Well, I very much hope to see whether, I'm sure if Jim makes another film, you'll pop up, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing
them in a bigger way.
Let's hope. Let's get the
where are you in London?
I'm just outside of London. I've got more chance of pestering Jim, right?
Yeah, and I'm gonna pester you when we come over there.
Amazing. That'd be perfect. Amazing. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Sky. It's been so much fun. Well,
likewise, dude. Talk soon.
And that was the amazing Sky Elobar. That was a lot of fun, right? I had a lot of fun with that conversation. We had a couple of moments. Sky had his dog on his lap, who I believe is mentioned at the end of this episode. Little Lulu, he was a little legend. If you haven't, I know I said it a couple of times in the episode, but if you haven't seen Joe Talbot's American Paradise, do seek that out if you can find it. If anyone knows like a legitimate way you can watch that, please do get in touch on all the socials, which is Caged In Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd, or drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. I say that because, I really want to be able to like own it, or however you can like just support it, basically, because it's super fun, and I very much hope that idea of it being turned into a HBO series comes off, because oh boy it's a lot of fun, as this episode was. It was so much fun, and again, a massive thanks to Sky. It was an absolute joy talking to him, and if you've enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can always do that at patreon.com/cagedinpod, where you get tons of cagey-filled conversations I have with my guests, because obviously at the moment we're very much on a Coppola bent. The conversation very much falls into that category. So head on over to Patreon, or I'll pop some links in the bio to the coffee app and stuff like that. Buy me a coffee if you can't afford to do the ongoing payment. That's totally understandable. I'll also be dropping in the show notes some of the places you can find some of the shorts, especially the Jim Hoskin Renegade and Crab shorts, because they're fantastic and you can watch them legally, and Jim's put them up there, and they're fantastic. So as always, guys, I have been Petrus Patsalos, I have been Caged In, and I'll catch you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective. home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.